Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science.
Today, we're bringing you a special episode of Life's Little Mysteries. Usually, we keep things pretty light, but this time, we're going to focus on a serious topic that everybody is talking about, and that's the SARS coronavirus 2, the virus that causes the disease COVID-19.
At Life Science, our reporters and our editors are tracking the latest coronavirus developments around the world, from global case numbers and quarantines to vaccine development to best practices for safety, prevention, and treatment.
Here with the latest coronavirus news is Life Science health reporter Nicoletta Lanis. She's at the forefront of our coronavirus coverage.
This episode was recorded on July 2nd and features Nicoletta's weekly coronavirus video update and Q&A. New updates are live streamed on Facebook every Thursday at 12 p.m. ET.
Hello, and welcome to this week's coronavirus update with Live Science. My name is Nicoletta Lanis, and I am a health reporter at the site, and I'm here to answer your questions about COVID-19, and I will begin with a brief update on news from the week to get us started. If you would like to see what I'll be talking about first this week, it is written in the caption of this video. Before we get started, I did just want to plug that Live Science will be featured on a radio program this Saturday that airs across 100 radio stations in the U.S. and is also posted online. The radio show is called Science Fantastic and is hosted by Dr. Michio Kaku, who is a well-known science communicator and physicist. So we'll be discussing more COVID news on that radio program this Saturday, and you can check it out on his website, Michio Kaku's website, as to when it might be airing in your area, if you're interested in tuning into that. Just to start us off with an update on case counts, as of now, we are seeing that there are more than 10.7 million cases accounted for across the globe. This is, again, likely a undercount of the true case numbers, but these are those that we've been able to spot through formal diagnostic testing. Worldwide, we're seeing that the global death toll is above 517,000 at this juncture. Here in the U.S., we have now accounted for more than 2.6 million cases of COVID-19, so a fair proportion of the global case count, and deaths have now risen above 128,000 nationwide. Just to give you kind of a landmark as to where we're at in the course of the pandemic, it's been about 6 months now since news first emerged from Wuhan reporting the emergence of this virus to the global community. So within that time, obviously, we've seen many developments, learning about how the virus works at a biological level, but also seeing advancements in diagnostic testing, advancements in treatment and vaccines, etc. If you have any questions about those, please comment in the comments below, and I'll try to get to your questions later. I'll be starting out talking about how we can track the surges in case count that are taking place across the U.S., what this means for tracking outbreaks into the future, and how you within your community might keep a handle on how bad the situation is in your region now and how that might be progressing into the future. The major metrics that health professionals look at are the test positivity rate. The test positivity rate is simply a description of how many diagnostic tests proportionally come back positive. So by taking this as a rate rather than a total, you can compare that to, you can control for any increases or decreases in overall testing. So in this way, you can track through time how that rate is changing. And this gives you an idea of how the true case counts are rising or falling, regardless of how many actual tests you're conducting within a community. For instance, New York's test positivity rate back around the beginning of April was averaging around 50%. So about 50% of tests being given out were coming back positive. Clearly, that indicates a massive amount of community spread and emergence of new cases. As of now, New York's positivity rate has dropped down to about 1.1%, so drastically different from what we saw earlier in the year. Another metric we look at is, of course, new hospitalizations, new people being admitted to the hospital with COVID-19. And we take that hospitalization rate on a 3 to 7 day average typically. And looking at hospitalization rate is also a good way to note surges while also controlling for any increases in testing, because those who are sick enough to be hospitalized are likely to be accounted for no matter the rate of testing, because as they come into the hospital with severe symptoms, they're going to be tested for COVID-19. So that won't, those numbers are not severely impacted by increases or decreases in testing overall. In addition to just checking in on new hospitalizations, we want to look at the overall burden on the local hospital system at large. So this is also taken on a 7 day rolling average, looking at, for instance, the number of ICU beds available for patients should they need them. And when that gets close to capacity, clearly that indicates that cases are surging. Now, with both new hospitalizations and overall burden on the hospital system, you're going to see a lag between new cases and when people become hospitalized, because it takes a number of weeks often for people to develop those severe symptoms. And also, now that we're seeing a higher proportion of younger people being asked to go back to work as the economy reopens, et cetera, or moving about their communities, perhaps more than elderly folks, we're seeing more people in younger age groups catch the virus, and you're going to see a lag both as they develop severe symptoms, but as they pass on the virus to more vulnerable elderly populations. So you see that delay in the case counts and hospitalization. And of course, throughout all this, contact tracing gives us a handle on how cases are changing throughout a region. Contact tracing describes when a person is identified as infected, we then go on within the healthcare system to contact each of their recent people that they've spent time in close proximity with. So that can include family members, that can include potentially even people at their local grocery store, all the places they've gone recently. You would want to reach out to those individuals and make sure they know they could possibly be exposed to the virus. The U.S. capacity for contact tracing varies town to town, state to state. So to track how well contact tracing is working, you can at the same time track the number of infections that are being identified without a clear source case. So it becomes unclear how that person caught the virus. And on that front, I wanted to talk briefly about a new survey that's come out that suggests that very few Americans with COVID-19 actually know how they picked up the virus in the first place. This, of course, is a survey, may not be representative of the U.S. at large, but just something to think about. These findings suggest that many people may be getting infected through community spread, so going out, shopping, interacting in the public sphere, rather than somebody they know personally who they know to have had a confirmed case of COVID-19. So those close contacts might be coworkers or family members, for instance. And this survey is based on telephone interviews with 350 adults across 9 states. So again, not necessarily representative completely, but these were people who tested positive for the virus back in late March to mid-May. And about 54% of these individuals were not aware of having close contact with anyone who had had COVID-19, according to the survey. This drives home the point that community spread was rampant at that time, but we know it's still rampant today, especially in states that are seeing surges in case counts. So this means measures like social distancing, measures like wearing a cloth mask at the least, or a surgical mask while you're out in public, all these measures are very important and will remain important if we're going to be able to move about in public without putting ourselves and our loved ones at risk. On the topic of masks, a new visualization experiment came out this week, which we wrote about, that has some eye-catching images if you want to check out the site. But this visualization used a mannequin and kind of a creative experimental setup, including a fog machine, to have this mannequin try on various masks, and they would blow droplets through said mask to see how the dispersion change depending on the mask material and compared to the mannequin without the mask. So they're finding that homemade masks with two layers of cotton fabric, at least 70 threads per inch, work pretty well at keeping any fluid blowing through the mask close to that person's face. So it remains within about 2.5 inches from the face, as compared to no mask at all, where these particles can travel up to 12 feet within about 50 seconds. So you have that mask and it all stays right here near your face, which is the point of them. So that's kind of a demonstration on how masks can help reduce spread. They also found that the cone style masks that you can buy at most pharmacies are similarly effective. They keep the particles within about 8 inches of your face. Why you're even seeing particles escape at all is that there are some gaps in these cloth masks and also these cone masks that allow the particles to escape via the nose or near the nose and around the chin. So you do see some particles get out, but they remain very close to the face. Now they're finding that bandanas and handkerchiefs are less effective, still better than absolutely nothing, but they only keep the particles within about 3.5 feet of someone's face and the handkerchief about in the range of a foot. So if you think about knowing that going forward, we're going to have to continue wearing masks in public for quite some time, you might consider investing in cloth masks or opting for these cone style masks if they're available to you. Of course, I'm talking about public spaces here, mask wearing, the importance of all these safety measures. I did want to touch on briefly staying safe from COVID-19 in elevators as people are going back to work in some places now, and some might be having to enter buildings with elevators to get through their office spaces. The CDC will be issuing guidelines sometime this week on the topic of elevators specifically, and suggest that all riders within an elevator should wear masks. You should limit the number of riders. People have said likely between 2 and 3 people can ride safely. Note that most elevators do not allow you to keep 6 feet of distance between yourselves. So if possible, riding by yourself, of course, is the best option. But in crowded buildings, especially like our usual office space in Manhattan, that's simply not possible most of the time. So just limiting the number of people within elevators, marking pads on the floor to guide people in and out more safely so they don't have to come in contact with so many people, and posting signs to remind everyone not to speak in the elevator if you do not absolutely have to. Speaking, now that we know about how the virus can spread through tiny mist-like particles, which are known as aerosols. These particles can be produced when someone speaks, when they sing, when they shout, not just when you cough and spray visible particles out of your mouth. So even speaking in an enclosed space like an elevator, which is typically poorly ventilated, can put those around you at risk of picking up the virus from you if you are infected. So if you have to ride an elevator right now, keep quiet and wear a mask. And if you can, you can point your face towards the corner of the elevator as well. And this just helps. If any aerosols were to come out of anyone's mouth, they would be directed towards the corners of the elevator rather than at the other people on board. There is some question as of now as to whether getting on the elevator after an infected person could pose any risk. At this point, there's no direct evidence of that. There is some evidence that if aerosols are spewed within an elevator at some point, or someone coughs and wasn't wearing masks especially, some of those viral particles, even with the opening and closing of the elevator doors, would remain suspended in the air. The question is, how many of those particles would someone then have to inhale to actually become infected? And that's a huge question we don't know the answer to. So likely riding by yourself, even if it's right after an infected person, is fairly low risk as far as we know. But just keep all these things in mind and please wear a mask in any public space, but especially in closed spaces like elevators. Kind of taking a detour, this is not directly coronavirus related, but I did want to touch on it briefly. You may have seen headlines come out this week about a quote-unquote new swine flu with quote-unquote pandemic potential. I want to dispel any potential worries from anyone. This is not an imminent health threat. In fact, this virus has been in existence for a number of years and has been circulating among certain populations of pigs minutely, at least within China, where these surveys have been conducted. And it does not appear to have a significant impact on human populations at this point. It's just a virus we're keeping an eye on. This is simply, I'm pointing this out only because we've talked a lot about, on this show in particular, how we might prevent the next pandemic. And doing preliminary studies like this, looking out for viruses that could potentially spark a pandemic, but before they become dangerous, this surveillance is incredibly important to keeping something like COVID from happening again. The headlines you're seeing are simply highlighting that this virus exists. We know it exists. It has been flagged and people will keep an eye on it. But let me just tell you a tiny bit about it and then we can get into your questions. So the new virus is related to the H1N1 swine flu that caused a pandemic in 2009. That pandemic in 2009 has been estimated to have resulted in more than 150,000 deaths worldwide and infected up to an estimated 1.4 billion people around the world. So nothing to scoff at, clearly. So the swine flu that we know to infect humans, H1N1, what we're thinking is it somehow came back into pigs, and given all the other pathogens that pigs are exposed to, especially farmed animals, it mutated through time and became this new virus, which is called G4EAH1N1. Most people just call it G4 because it's much faster to say. So a new study came out Monday in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which is a scientific journal, that found evidence that this virus has infected some workers on pig farms in China. But there's no indication that the virus yet spreads between people. It's more likely that these people picked it up directly from pigs, not each other, as far as we know. And they only found evidence of antibodies in these people. So antibody tests are a little, you should take their results with a grain of salt, simply because they search for antibodies that are specific to different structures on a virus. And some of these structures are shared between different viruses. So it's difficult to come up with antibody tests that are highly specific to especially a brand new virus that we're learning about. So there is some, again, just take the results with a grain of salt, but they did find within a sampling of workers who work on pig farms in China that some people bore antibodies to this virus. It should be noted that this virus has been a dominant flu strain among pigs in at least this population of pigs in China since about 2016. So it's 2020 now. This virus has been in circulation among at least this one group of pigs, which is a fairly diverse group, but does not represent all of the pigs in China, let alone all the pigs across the world. So there's no evidence it's been circulating among humans actively, despite 5 years of potential exposure, more than 5 years of potential exposure. And this is the context you should keep this news in mind, is just that we know this virus exists. We're going to keep an eye on it, see if any mutations would make it more likely to spark a pandemic or an epidemic of smaller scale. And this is how we should surveil viruses into the future and in attempts to prevent future pandemics. So that's how you should read those headlines when they come out. And on that note, I will take your questions about COVID-19, coming back to the current public health disaster. I'm getting a question about mutations of the virus. There's been some rumor that a less severe version of the virus is now circulating. Specifically, this has been stated in Florida. I would begin by saying, while the virus is continually mutating, as all viruses do, it is not yet mutated dramatically enough to be considered diverging into new strains, as far as we know. There are various mutations that appear to be coming throughout the pandemic, becoming dominant strains, and this could be for various reasons, but they're simply occurring in higher abundance than other lineages that we're seeing. When I say lineage, it simply means that as the virus mutates, like any evolutionary tree, you get these lineages that branch off from that original virus. So we see many, many lineages of this virus. there is no evidence thus far that a less severe or less contagious version is circulating. Rather, what we're seeing in Florida as case counts are going up, this is true of other places as well, and it's infecting young people, is simply that more young people are out and about, in part because as people go back to work, a lot of young people have jobs. And this is true of many demographics, obviously, but it's not simply because of young people being out partying. That's just simply one dimension. There are people doing that and they shouldn't be doing that. But more broadly, if more people are out and about in the community, whether at their places of work, going about their daily lives, shopping at retail stores, spending a lot of time indoors around other people, all these things are dangerous for spread. And we knew that from the start. Just to wrap up, there's no strong evidence of a less severe version of this virus circulating at this time. It seems to be functioning much like the virus mutates relatively slowly compared to, say, an influenza virus. So as of yet, we don't see divergent strains coming off and functioning dramatically different from earlier versions of the virus. I'm getting a question about the frequency of asymptomatic transmission. Asymptomatic transmission, for anyone who hasn't heard that term before, asymptomatic refers to individuals that become infected with the virus but never develop symptoms. Some people are pre-symptomatic, meaning they don't show symptoms at first, and then they go on to develop symptoms later. And of course, early on, it's hard to differentiate between these groups. As of yet, I've seen it estimated that about 40% of the spread of the virus might be attributed to asymptomatic transmission. I do want to point out within these estimates that we do not observe viral transmission directly. It's impossible to do so. Scientists are doing detective work after the fact to try to parse out, okay, how many of these cases likely came from someone who didn't realize they were infected and didn't have overt symptoms? How many of these came from people who were clearly sick and had a confirmed case? All things like that. So the estimates will continue to change as this goes on. Eventually, we'll nail down exactly how much asymptomatic transmission is happening. All I can say is it's definitely happening. The percentage is non-negligible. So given that we know it's possible, everyone should be wearing masks in public spaces because you don't know if you have the virus. And just to round back to that quickly, there's been numerous case studies that show this on a smaller scale, that asymptomatic spread can result in super spreader events. So you as the single asymptomatic person can then go on to spread the virus to, say, dozens of other individuals, having never known that you had the virus in the first place. So to not be that person, wear masks. I'm getting a question about studies that look into proving that masks do not work. If you look at livescience.com, you'll find a story that details what experts say about mask wearing. And we, within that story, interview a number of experts who question how helpful masks are. So if you want to hear the dissenting opinions, those are outlined clearly in that article, and you can refer to that. But the point being that while we do not know how helpful masks are, I can't give you an exact percentage because the estimates vary. We do know that they are highly, highly likely to help. And they are most effective if most people in a community are wearing them. If only one person is wearing a mask and everyone surrounding them is not, the mask is no longer helpful because only that one person is keeping the virus from exiting them and getting to other people. So mask wearing is a community effort, and we can see it demonstrated on smaller scales how it is effective at slowing the spread of COVID-19. But please refer to that article in livescience.com about mask wearing specifically, and you can see what other experts have to say. This is a good question. This person is asking about pre-existing conditions such as high blood pressure potentially exacerbating COVID-19 symptoms. This is the case. They are asking if this is still the case for pharmaceutically controlled conditions. So especially we've seen studies referencing diabetes especially and other blood sugar conditions. it would seem that you fare better if you have whatever that pre-existing condition is under control, given your current medication regimen. So yes, it seems that taking those medications to, say, control your blood pressure, control your insulin levels, all that sort of thing, is helpful in lowering your risk for severe symptoms. I would say that you are still in a high-risk category, though, just simply by having the condition to start with, but you can reduce your risk by continuing to take medications that help to control those pre-existing conditions. That has been seen. And you can look, if you look at the CDC website, they have a list, a very comprehensive list of both conditions that have been confirmed to be linked to more severe cases of COVID, and then a longer list of conditions that people are still looking into. And that page on the CDC website gets into more details about what we know about taking medications that help to control those various pre-existing conditions. I'm getting a question about how long it takes for an infected person to have reliable results from a PCR test, meaning essentially, when should you go in to get tested? So if you are in the earliest stages of the infection, let's say, for example, in this case, you have a mild infection, so you might develop overt symptoms such as at least a mild fever, a dry cough, digestive symptoms, other things like this. Your viral load, which is the amount of virus present in your body, will ramp up within about the first 2 to 6 to 7 days of having become infected. So if you become exposed to the virus and you become infected and you got a test that very same day, you might not test positive simply because your viral loads are still very, very low. So sometimes somewhere in the middle of that 2 to 7 day window, so around day 5, might be an optimal time to receive a PCR test because your viral load at that point will be high enough to reliably detect. In that time, a person is contagious, is the second half of that person's question. We are seeing at least early studies hinted that people are actually at their most infectious with this virus early on in the course of illness. So within a few days of developing symptoms, at least in mild cases, people shed, give off many, many viral particles as compared to later in the course of infection when they're on the road to recovery. This timeline differs when you have a more severe case. So you see that the viral loads and viral shedding peak a few days after symptom onset for those milder cases. And then in severe cases, that peak shifts down the timeline. So it might be more in the second week of infection to the third week of infection, something like that. But again, this varies from person to person. Simply saying that even early on when you have the virus and you do have an active infection, you can infect other people, which again is why mask wearing is important. And social distancing is an even more tried and true measure than mask wearing. Because if you're not in the space with other people that you can infect, it's impossible to infect them at that point. I'm getting a question about how this person saw a headline. This was a New York Times story that they're referencing about how COVID-19 may affect T cells, which are a type of immune cell, similarly to the HIV virus. This headline and story come from a number of preprints, meaning these studies have not yet been reviewed by the scientific community, and they have not yet been published in a formal scientific journal. That said, many of the studies we see coming out right now are preprints, but just take it with a massive grain of salt as you read it. But there has been scattered evidence about COVID-19 potentially depleting the body's levels of certain T cells. I will say that T cells come in many flavors, and this article doesn't go into really deep, it doesn't probe deeply which T cells specifically are being depleted, and it may not be uniform across all people infected with the virus. So for instance, we see in children are more capable of generating new naive T cells. These are T cells that have not yet encountered any pathogens and so are not prepared to fight off these new pathogens. Whereas experienced T cells, I'll say, have been circulating in the body and can naturally proliferate on their own. And these are specific to various pathogens that the body has met before. But in general, children are able to generate these naive T cells from their thymus glands more readily than older adults can. So especially elderly populations above 75, but even beginning around the 40s, we see a drop off in this level of naive T cell production. What these preprints are doing is they're raising a lot of questions as to, okay, if COVID-19 is in fact depleting populations of T cells, which T cells exactly? How are those T cells involved in fighting off the virus in different populations of people specifically, and especially different age groups? And is there a way that we can interfere in that process to help treat patients? Mostly raising more questions and answering questions, but it is something that people are continuing to look at. And I'll be interested to see if and when those preprints move into formal journals. Getting a question about, will the new norm now include wearing masks years even after a potential vaccine is introduced and effective? Personally, again, this is my view as a science journalist, as a person, I would not be upset by an increase in mask wearing overall, particularly during influenza season, which we already know about, and during the early spring when other infectious diseases are circulating, common colds, things of that nature. We already see this as the norm in many other countries, that during peak flu season and other periods with high rates of infectious disease transfer, we see people wearing masks, especially in public spaces and especially on public transport. For instance, on the metro system in Japan, you would see many people wearing masks during peak infectious disease seasons. And I think, generally speaking, we've seen it be effective at stemming the transmission of seasonal influenza. That's been shown by these other countries that have adopted these methods of public health already. So it certainly would not be a bad thing to see mask wearing become more ubiquitous, particularly in times of the year when we know it's a big problem. I don't know if that would be in all public spaces all the time. My guess would be that at some point people will stop wearing masks everywhere and in all seasons, but perhaps around, again, that time of the year that influenza comes back online and we see more people catching colds, all that sort of thing. We might see that seasonal increase in mask wearing, which I think would be a good thing. And just to plug the website quickly, if there are any questions that I didn't get to, we cover, I believe, all of these that you're asking, if not most of them, on livescience.com. in the form of one of our articles. And you can also go to the forums at forums.livescience.com, which is a place where various readers of Live Science can come and pose their questions and discuss our articles as they come out. If you do have any lingering questions that we haven't gotten to, you may see them addressed in future stories. I'm getting a question about whether COVID-19, once dispelled into the air via an aerosol, remains in the air 24/7. For instance, hanging in a cloud that doesn't dissipate and, you know, accumulating through time. The virus through time, once outside of the body, has a limited, I'll call it lifespan. Viruses aren't necessarily considered to be alive, but it has a limited period of viability where it can still infect things once exiting its host, which is the body, which is the cells within our body. So once the virus is suspended in aerosols, if it doesn't reach a host in time, it will die off, become inactive, and no longer be able to infect cells. So we see that diminishing through time, and eventually those aerosols would not contain the virus anymore. Beyond that, especially in open air, for instance, when you're walking around outside, those viral particles are going to be dispersed in the environment. Aerosols simply take the path of least resistance through the air. So any way that the air is flowing is where those aerosols are going to go. And this is partially why outdoor spaces are less risky for transfer than indoor spaces, because indoor spaces, particularly poorly ventilated ones, trap the air, and it has even if it's being ventilated through, say, an air conditioning system, it's still going to be more stagnant and accumulate more quickly than, say, in an outdoor space, where it could float away from the person and become so diluted with the surrounding air that it's no longer of risk to passerby. So to answer your question succinctly, no, COVID does not remain in the air permanently once exiting the body. It does have a limited span of viability, but it is notable that it can be picked up in the air. And most likely how you'll pick it up is you would breathe it in. And given that those aerosols are so small, they can get fairly deep into your lungs, which can spark more severe infection than if it only was isolated to your upper respiratory tract. So there is that concern with aerosols, especially a high dose of viral particles contained in aerosols. The CDC, just rounding back to that question quickly, the CDC has recommended that especially office spaces, which often have poor air ventilation, should be outfitted to better ventilate the air. And this would be a great way of reducing the risk of spread within enclosed spaces. And this would be true of elevators. This would be true of shopping malls. This would be true of any indoor space that could require better ventilation than it currently has. Getting a question about if there's any new updates about transmission through food or grocery deliveries or takeout, to lump that into the category. Generally speaking, it's thought that the primary routes for the virus to get into your body are via either respiratory droplets, which are those larger particles that you spew when you cough. So you can usually see those. They're fairly large and they fall due to gravity to the ground some distance from a person. Or these aerosols, where they can linger in the air for some time. So respiratory droplets and aerosols are thought to be the most likely ways that you could pass on the virus to another person. Picking up the virus from a surface, say that be your grocery delivery or your takeout containers, things like that, picking up a virus from a surface and then depositing it onto some vulnerable tissue, which might be your eyes, your nose, and your mouth, this is thought to be less likely. But of course, you have to remember not to touch your face and to wash your hands consistently. So as long as you're doing those things, the risk of picking up an infection from a food delivery is very, very low. But you, again, have to wash your hands and you should avoid touching your face unnecessarily, things like that. In terms of preparing food, especially exposed foods like perhaps vegetables that aren't always wrapped up in plastic, so you might not have that barrier of protection that you can then throw away. If you just wash them normally, as you usually do with water, and then especially if you're cooking them, that risk of transmission from eating contaminated food is considered very, very, very low. If you are nervous at all about your food having become contaminated, especially fresh produce, again, the virus has a limited liability on surfaces that aren't our cells. So if you quarantined your food for a couple days, then the virus would be gone. In addition, cooking your food, the heat would kill the virus off. So you can also consider that option if you're nervous about picking up from food. But know that that risk is incredibly low compared to other ways you could catch the virus. There hasn't been any evidence of transfer from food products being consumed. I think I have one more question left here. This person is asking about recent studies that suggest that people either generate a low number of antibodies from their original infection or that high level of antibodies drops off fairly quickly. I have seen studies that suggest that while overall antibody count might become low after the original infection wears off, the proportion of neutralizing antibodies remains fairly high regardless of how severe your original infection was. There's still variants, but these neutralizing antibodies, which are those that latch on to a pathogen and help to actually disable it while also calling other immune cells to the site to help deactivate that pathogen. So there's many questions surrounding what level of antibodies is required to translate into a lasting and robust immune response. This is an open question. So any studies you see come out about that are simply inching towards that, the answer to that question. And that's all I've seen thus far. There's no standout study that's hyper conclusive at this point pointing to exactly how antibody levels translate into immunity. We don't know the answer to that question yet. That said, people are thinking that a high enough level of neutralizing antibodies generated by either a natural infection or a vaccine should be enough to confer immunity for at least some period of time after that initial exposure. So that period of time might not be forever. It might be a year, it might be 2 years, and then you might need to get a booster or some new vaccine to keep yourself protected against the virus. But we are seeing thus far, there's a number of vaccines in clinical trials. Some are in the latest stage of clinical trials, phase 3 trials. There's 3 in those at this point. And those are showing robust immune responses among people that have been given the vaccine so far. So that's all very promising. We're still learning more about these vaccines. We're still learning more about immunity. You asked how vaccines work differently to a natural infection. They work differently simply because the natural infection exposes you to the full-fledged virus, and then you can potentially contract a very severe illness, or at least some illness. Whereas the vaccine, the goal is to not give you any symptoms of the actual disease that the virus would cause. So that's the main difference in why vaccines are great for driving down hospital rates, are great for conferring immunity, all that sort of thing. That said, vaccines can be made via a number of different modalities, meaning they can be based on different biological structures. Some vaccines use the whole virus and either weaken that virus so it can no longer infect cells properly or deactivate the virus completely. And simply by being exposed to that virus in whole, the body mounts an immune response but does not make that person sick. You might have brief symptoms shortly after receiving a vaccine simply by virtue of that immune response coming online. So you might feel a little feverish, and then that dissipates through time. That's an acceptable side effect of a vaccine. You also see vaccines now being developed that are based on the genetic material within a virus rather than the whole virus. So this genetic material would be introduced, and then the body's cells actually build proteins that are found within and on top of the virus, on the surface of the virus. And once those proteins are built, the body recognizes those and builds antibodies. So that's a faster way of developing vaccines because you're simply working from that genetic material rather than having to make sure that whole virus is safe to inject into a person, because obviously that's very risky, but if it works, it's the gold standard for vaccines, is to use this whole attenuated virus. You also see beyond the genetic material, sometimes people introduce simply one tiny piece of a virus, being one protein or a collection of proteins, things like this. So many modalities in the works right now, and this is how this differs from natural infection, is that you have either the full-fledged virus and you personally don't know how you will react to that. It's very much a gamble versus dealing with a vaccine that has gone through numerous safety and efficacy trials that mounts a similar response, but without making you sick. So that's the purpose and the pros of vaccine use. And on that note, I'm going to wrap up for the week. Again, we're going to be featured on Science Fantastic this Saturday if you would like to tune into that radio program. If you just search that, the schedule for radio stations in your area should pop up online. If not, feel free to come back and ask more questions of me this time next week.
Thanks for joining us for this special coronavirus report from Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. You can find all the Live Science coverage of the coronavirus and COVID-19 on our website at livescience.com/topics/coronavirus.
We'll be refreshing our FAQ and coronavirus updates daily as information becomes available. The link is in the show notes.
If you have questions about coronavirus or COVID-19, you can post them on our Live Science forums and on Facebook.
Thanks for joining us, and stay healthy.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals network.